Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Monday, November 9th, 2015. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, we'll discuss Tuesday evening's free presentation offered by the City Museum on the last executions in Alaska. Andy Klein will be here with news about the Alaskan Brewing Company's new limited edition smoked porter. We'll talk with Pete Griffin about Saturday's celebration at the Mendenhall Public Library. We'll talk with Samantha Stodinger from the CBJ about the city's wastewater system. And we'll find out more about the Gastineau Humane Society and Friday's wine and beer tasting and silent auction. Those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music and more right here on a Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Premier of Quebec says he won't rule out a provincial investigation into relations between First Nations people and police. This after allegations that officers abused women. Native leaders had demanded a meeting with the Premier, which he later agreed to. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
Premier Philippe Couillard has been under pressure since the allegations surfaced a few weeks ago. Couillard announced more money for projects and confirmed there would be an independent observer looking into the accusations against police. And he reminded the new federal government in Ottawa to live up to its promises with respect to the country's First Nations.
Communities that don't have running water or electricity in a G20 country, how can this be acceptable? So I call on the federal government, and I feel some good faith on their part and sincerity in wanting to change things.
Couillard's comments were welcomed by native leaders such as Ghislain Picard of the Assembly of First Nations of Quebec.
At the same time, we have to remain open because as we witness and hear potentially other situations in other regions of Quebec, then we certainly have to be mindful that this situation could spread right across the region.
Meanwhile, the Montreal Police Force has been called in to probe the allegations against the provincial police, allegations of assault, sexual misconduct, and other abuses of power. Eight officers based in Val-d'Or have been suspended pending the investigation. Some chiefs say police relations with Native communities should still be the subject of a provincial inquiry. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Muscogee Creek Nation voters in Oklahoma ousted their principal chief in Saturday's general election. As KGOU's Brian Hartzinski reports, the outgoing chief's term was mired in controversy.
By an almost 2-to-1 margin, Muscogee Creek citizens elected James Floyd, the tribe's new principal chief, Saturday. He's the retired director of a Veterans Administration Medical Center in Muscogee and has also worked with Indian Health Services. He'll take office in January. Outgoing Chief George Tiger received a no-confidence vote from the tribe's National Council earlier this year, and a grassroots petition calling for his impeachment failed after organizers didn't get the signatures of at least 20% of registered Creek voters. In March, the Tulsa World newspaper revealed Tiger signed a secret contract in 2009 with a casino that would have competed with the Creek Nation's own facility. Tiger has said he did nothing wrong because he was not chief when the deal took place. I'm Brian Hartzinski in Norman, Oklahoma.
The Associated Press reports the Flandreau Santee Sioux Tribe is putting its marijuana resort project on hold while it seeks clarification from state and federal officials. Existing crops were destroyed over the weekend. The South Dakota tribe legalized marijuana in June and planned to open its recreational business next year. At last week's Tribal Nations Conference in Washington, President Obama laid out an economic agenda for tribes. Matt Laszlo has more.
In a panel with young students, the president was asked about how parts of Indian country still lack basic amenities needed to live. President Obama decried the shabby conditions that persist on many tribal lands.
It's not acceptable that anybody doesn't have running water in this country, right? So that's just a straightforward matter of getting the help from Congress to help build out the infrastructure that people need.
But the president said the federal government still doesn't hold all the answers.
We have to think about sustainable development. So the idea is not just that the tribe is getting money from the federal government. The question is, how do we give tribes the tools whereby they can start generating jobs and economic development and progress on their own terms within their communities?
The president and the administration have been pushing green energy projects in Indian country. but it's unclear if they will be enough to pull many tribes out of poverty. I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. With funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Support by Indigenous Governance Programs at the University of Arizona, educating practitioners and policymakers to implement nation-building at home and create stronger Native nations. Course offerings at igp.arizona.edu.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, November 9th, 2015. Scott Burton, your host, currently in Juno. It's about 42 degrees and a blustery, close to 40 mile per hour wind gusts. But it's warm here in the KTOO studios, and joining me now is a post-conviction lawyer, Avril Lerman. Welcome to the show, Avril.
Hello.
Nice to have you. And the director of the Juno Douglas City Museum, Jane Lindsay. Welcome to the show, Jane.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's nice to have you both inside. We're going to be talking about your presentation on Tuesday night at the Juno Douglas City Museum, and it's about the last two executions.
That's right.
Here in the state of Alaska. Avril, tell us about those. Let's start there.
Well, the last two men, Alaska had a death penalty until 2 years before statehood. In 1957, the territorial legislature abolished the death penalty. The last hangings that happened in Alaska all happened in Juneau. And the last two men who were hanged here in Juneau were tried in 47 and 48 and hanged in, one was hanged in 1948, one was hanged in 1950.
Right here in Juneau.
Right here in Juneau.
Where were the actual hanging, where did they take place?
They were in what was called then the old courthouse building, which actually housed the federal jail and the marshal's dwelling, which is the same place where the state office building is presently.
Okay. You're working on a book about these two hangings. What drew you to this case?
My profession until I retired fairly recently was as a lawyer, a post-conviction lawyer, representing people who'd been convicted of crimes and who were asserting that their conviction had been wrong or erroneous. And I started working on this even before I started that profession. I was concerned when the legislature, Alaska legislature, was going to consider reinstating the death penalty, and I thought I'd look into the record of what happened back when we did have a death penalty here in Alaska and see if we did it better than people have done it in California and Florida. And that's how I first met these cases, and that was in the early 1990s.
Okay. Jane, how did you meet Avril and get this going?
Well, I'm part of Museums Alaska, and every year we have a joint conference with the Alaska Historical Society. So I was in Cordova attending sessions. Historians and museum professionals go there to learn more about the field and also just to present papers. And I went to Avril's presentation and realized how important the information was, and also how good of a job she was doing as a researcher using primary source materials, and how careful she was with the information that she was presenting. So after her presentation, I went up and introduced myself and said, would you ever be interested in coming to Juneau to do this presentation, because it happened here. And, of course, our museum is very close to the site, which is now the state office building. And she said yes, and so here she is.
I know you're going to talk about this in detail on Tuesday night. Give us some of the details about this case, the men's names, where the supposed crime took place.
Well, a real crime did take place. It was a terrible murder of a longtime Juno man named Jim Ellen, who was found dead on the floor of his store on Willoughby Avenue. He had a little liquor grocery store and lived there in the back of the store. He was murdered in December of 46. Within an hour after his body was found, the first man was arrested. The first man's name was Austin Nelson. He was an African-American man, a transient, a man who had a bad record of not behaving well. There was little evidence against him, but there was some evidence against him, and then other things happened. There was more evidence against him. The other man who was subsequently charged quite a bit later was Eugene L'Amour, who was a Juneau man, a family man, had wife and children, worked for a living, and he was tried also and hanged. The jury who was charged to decide the punishment for Eugene L'Amour tried to ask the judge if the judge would do it, and the judge said no. And there are many circumstances and issues having to do with the trials of the two men that raise serious questions about whether or not one or both of them were guilty or innocent. It's not clear to me.
Okay. I think you've expressed it a little bit. May I ask what your view on capital punishment was sort of going into this research, and has it changed?
Well, before I became a lawyer, I was kind of in favor of the death penalty. It seemed like it might be a fair thing to do. And also, it seemed to me that it might be deterrent to people like me, who would they say, well, I don't think I want the death penalty, maybe I won't kill my husband. And so I thought that it might be, I mean, I wasn't sure what I thought, I just thought it might be okay. As I became a lawyer and became involved in criminal proceedings, I started to understand exactly what a crapshoot the whole thing is at every level, from the point of time where a charging decision is made to the point in time when you get an attorney, to how your attorney deals with you. There's so many different levels on which things can and do go wrong. And after realizing that, I'm not comfortable. Some people are comfortable with executing people who might not be guilty, but that doesn't seem to me to be a good social policy, and so I'm very much against the death penalty at this point for that reason and for other reasons as well.
Interesting. What can people expect on Tuesday night?
I am hoping that they can expect a good story that is as close to the facts as I can keep it. And I'm hoping that the people who come will tell me where I'm wrong, if I'm wrong about anything, and share their own experiences with me as well. But the narrative is very interesting. It's got everything primetime TV can offer, except commercials.
Jane, can you give us the details on Tuesday night?
Sure. It's at the museum, and we're located at 4th and Main Street, and it will start at 7 p.m. We'll probably open the doors sometime a little after 6:30 p.m. And as many of you know who've been to the museum, it's not a large space, so we're expecting to be able to seat about 45 people, and it's free.
Okay. Well, it sounds really interesting. Thank you both for coming on the show and telling us about this. Avril, is there anything else you'd like to add?
I'm very, very pleased to be here in Juneau to share this story with people here.
Okay. Thanks, you two. We'll see you on Tuesday night.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lord, I don't want to die in the storm. I don't want to die in the storm. Let the wind blow east. Let the wind blow west. Lord, I don't want to die in the storm. My mother, she died in the storm. My mother, she died in the storm. Let the wind blow east, let the wind blow west. Lord, I don't want to die in the storm. King Pharaoh, he died in the storm. King Pharaoh, he died in the storm. Let the wind blow east, let the wind blow west. Lord, I don't want to die in the storm. I don't want to die in the storm. I don't want to die in the storm. Let the wind blow east, let the wind blow west. Lord, I don't want to die in the storm.
Is Bird Note. As the colder months arrive, birds that remain in northern climates face the harsh realities of staying warm and finding food. Some birds approach the food problem by storing it in advance, in a behavior called caching. Chickadees, nuthatches, jays, and some woodpeckers are known to cache large supplies of mostly seeds in a great many places. Scatter hoarding, it's called. A kind of adaptive specialization that requires very good spatial memory. So, what enables the birds to find the seeds they've stored? Scientists have shown that black-capped chickadees amplify their spatial memory in early fall by actually adding brain cells to the hippocampus, the part of the brain that supports spatial memory. Taking the question a step further, another study examined how severity of climate might affect the brain power of different populations of chickadees. These researchers found that where a stash of winter food is critical, say in harsher northern climates, black-capped chickadees had a substantially larger hippocampus size and more neurons in this part of the brain than those birds from more mild southern regions. In other words, when the living is easy, having a big brain isn't such a big deal. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, November 9th, 2015. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 17 minutes after the hour. I've been joined in the studio now by a couple of storytellers. Mr. Pete Griffin, welcome to the show, Pete.
Hey, Scott.
And Tom Cosgrove, welcome to the show, Tom.
Welcome. Thank you.
All right. So, Telebration this Saturday at the new Mendenhall Library?
Yeah, that's correct.
So, Telebration alludes to celebration.
Oh, it is. It's a international celebration of storytelling. It started back in the early 80s on the East Coast, and it was for the first Saturday before Thanksgiving. And that grew, spread state to state, and now it's an international event where folks get together to tell stories.
Okay. What are the details? What time does it start? And who's invited?
Starts at 6 o'clock to 7:30. We've got 7 local Juno storytellers lined up, all terrific stories, and they're family-friendly, generally for teen audiences and above. But there's nothing in there that little kids would be frightened by.
I got a favorite way to say it, because one of the things when you talk, people think storytelling, they're thinking Itsy Bitsy Spider or Little Red Riding Hood, and no, this is the storytelling from around the fire, pre-television, pre-radio, and so I like to use the term PG-8, which means may not hold the attention of those under 8 years old.
I like that.
So it's not mature audiences; it just you have to be able to sit still and listen.
You guys are both prolific storytellers. You've been telling stories for a long time here in the community and elsewhere, I suspect. What is it that draws you guys to the art of storytelling?
Ah, wow. So my personal theory is that Homo sapiens developed. Storytelling was an important part of their development, because if you couldn't consume a story and understand it, you didn't know how to get away from the bears or which berries not to eat. So we are in tune to listening and telling stories. And I have told stories in one way or another since I was a kid, and I think it's been a part of me for that long. It's just took me a long time to get it out there.
Well, it's as important to human development as the opposable thumb. There's a saying I just love. It says the opposable thumb gave us the ability to grip something, but stories tell us what's important to grip.
Well wow, said, Pete.
Indeed.
So, you know, that's how we pass on our knowledge from, you know, our grandparents to our parents to us to our kids. A story will teach a young person a lot more than an abstract idea on a chalkboard.
And, you know, it's the power that Lincoln had was being able to take a concept or a story, or take a story to illustrate a concept. He would tell you a story. He would never tell them necessarily what to do, but when you left the room, you knew because of the story that he told, and it provided guidance. It's a powerful forum for us.
Okay. Is there a theme on Saturday?
No.
No.
No rules. Bring what you got.
There'll be personal stories. There'll be Native American stories. There'll be traditional fables. It's just a wide variety of stories Saturday night.
So are you doing a personal experience story?
I am. That's my specialty. The parent's burden.
When you take a personal experience story, Pete, how do you whittle it down to figure out, you know, what's essential in that story?
Boy, when I first concoct a story, first craft a story, it's generally very long and full of all kinds of wonderful imagery. And when I tell it, a lot of things fall to the side. And fall off because they aren't directly related to the story. So eventually it's pared down from what might be 8 or 10 or 12 minutes into 4 or 5 minutes of events that carry the story and carry the meaning. And at the end of it, people say, ah, I see.
So that, you tell no, me? I mean, that's it in a nutshell. If the element doesn't carry the story forward, it's expendable and probably should. And a pitfall that we all fall into is like, oh, this is something that's really cool. It's fun to say. It's this little side thing. But it's really an offshoot. If you could take it out and the story will survive, and you got to have the courage to pluck those out. People's mind will wander. It makes for a more powerful story. It's more succinct.
So I know a lot of writers enjoy the editing process. Do you guys tell stories as and have them edited as you go? Do you have people that you confide in? How's that work for you guys?
Oh, boy, I do almost all my own editing. I think the best training I got in editing was when I was doing Tongass Trails on KTOO. And I had a 3-minute slot, and I would write a script that took 5 minutes, and it was hard to pare out all that stuff that was just wonderful, but it wasn't contributing toward the main idea I was trying to get across. So I do a lot. My editing is self-editing.
How about you, Tom?
I spend a lot of time editing. I get it, and so I start talking out loud to myself. And you realize, that doesn't sound natural. It doesn't sound natural. It doesn't sound natural. So you end up changing the language. And for me, you know, if I can easily remember it, it's correct language. And because it's naturally coming out of me. And if I'm like working on what's, I'm like, yeah, that doesn't quite work. So it's an editing process. Also, telling the same story over time. Well, I'm doing a story Saturday that I originally did 3 years ago. It's a story I have on manatees. It's one of my favorite and a fan favorite also. But I haven't told it in probably 18 months. And I went back to it. And it's a different story now. It's tighter. It's leaner. It's a much better story. It's the same story, but it's a lot tighter. I dropped a lot of stuff.
Do you guys write your stories down and do any work on them there, or is this all oral tradition for you?
Mostly mine. I develop mine in my head before I put anything to paper, and I'll think about them for months on end, and sometimes years before I will tell it. And sometimes after I tell it, then I may write it down. So I want to keep it in this shape so when I go back to it, I can maneuver from that, but I'll always have that snapshot of what it was on this date that I wrote it down.
Well, Pete, do you talk to yourself?
I don't.
Oh, come on.
I think that's really weird, Tom.
It is, because that's one of the things. Everyone's like, God, you're talking to yourself, like, all the time, because I'm working out something and going, it's like, you know, it's everywhere and constant, so it's somewhat embarrassing.
Well, my wife knows when I'm working on a story, because I will sometimes close my eyes and start making facial expressions. The first time she saw me do it, she thought I was having a seizure. What are you doing? I'm telling my story in my head. Oh, stop it, she said.
Well, to meet these two guys and some others, tell us who else is involved. Tom?
We got Becky Bear, who's been a longtime storyteller here in Juneau. Grace Elliott, who is, of course, another longtime storyteller in town. Ann Fuller. Pat McClear, who's been a partner of mine on a couple of projects I've done, and Johnny B. Perkins.
Okay. 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the new Mendenhall Library. Meet these guys and those storytellers and hear their stories for Telebration. Sounds like a lot of fun. Anything else you guys want to add?
Oh, tell your kids a story.
No doubt. Come on out. Thanks.
Thanks, Scott.
Tell me a story. Tell me of princes, jesters, and kings, town fools, crown jewels, scepters, and rings, goodies and little girls lost in the woods. Tell me of axes.
You're listening to A Juneau Afternoon here on Monday, November 9th, 2015. Scott Britton, your host. It's about 29 minutes after the hour. Joining me now in the studio is Samantha Stoudinger. She's the utility superintendent for the CBJ. Welcome to the show, Samantha.
Thank you, Scott.
Yeah, nice to have you here. So wastewater in Juneau. Can you give us 101?
Sure. So the wastewater is essentially, if you use your faucets, you shower, you do laundry, when that water goes down from where you leave it through the system, it comes to us and we treat it. There's a series of different pump stations that get it to one of our three different treatment plants.
How many pump stations do we have, give or
take? We have 45 pump stations and three treatment plants.
And where are the treatment plants?
So there are two relatively equally sized treatment plants. One is on South Fane, which is our Juneau Douglas. The other one is in Mendenhall, which is by the airport bike trail. And a third smaller one is in Ock Bay.
All right. So the pump stations get all of our wastewater to those two facilities. What happens then?
So it goes, all the wastewater goes through their, the treatment plants are a little different from themselves, but essentially they go through a screening process and then a biological degradation. The liquid stream is separated from the solid stream, and then the liquid stream is treated with UV sent into the channel, or Mendenhall River, and the solid stream actually is right now dewatered and shipped down south.
So after that UV treatment, that water is benign and can go in the river and the channel, I imagine?
Right. The microbes are inactivated, and it's meeting all compliance requirements. And so then, yes, it's returned to the system.
Okay. And the waste, you say, goes down south?
Yeah. So that's the biosolids component, which most people have probably been hearing about for quite some time. Several years ago, we had an incinerator that had failed, and then the decision had been made to either landfill or ship down south. Right now we are shipping roughly 7,000 wet tons of our biosolids down to a landfill in Oregon. And what that really entails is getting as much water out as possible, putting the sludge into, or the biosolids into, bagged containers, large shipping containers, that are then transported to AML, put on a barge, transported down to Seattle Yard, taken off, put on rail, then railed all the way down to Central Oregon, taken into the landfill, dumped, and the containers are returned about 28 days later.
Wow. And what was that number again for how much?
So 7,000 wet tons. So,
and what's that look like containers per year-wise, give or take?
We do about anywhere between 10 and 15 containers a week. Right.
Wow.
So, and you may see them on our trucks. They're the brown containers that go through town, and it's quite a costly process. So that's a continuing influent to the plant, and we have to get rid of it. This is the chosen method right now. We have begun and have been undertaking a research to find a better, more sustainable, long-term local solution, and we are still continuing to work that through the assembly. And there are some good alternatives. Obviously, shipping down south at a cost of about $2 million a year is not ideal. So.
Right, right. What can we do as consumers to help you guys out?
So I think that's part of why we came out with the educational brochure. What we really want to do is just let the ratepayers and citizens know that by just disposing of the appropriate materials down the drain or the toilet, it's easier on our system. It's less maintenance. It's less deterioration of the pumps. So really stick to just the bodily fluids and the toilet paper down the drain. Anything else that you may think or have put down there before, it really doesn't belong down there. It's not the appropriate place, and it does wear down the system over time.
Yeah, what kind of challenges does that cause for you and your technicians at the plants when weird stuff comes through?
Well, it's even before it gets there. You know, people obviously experience clogs in their own side sewer connection. Then once it gets to our lift stations, we have to pull apart the pumps, rebuild them. So there's a lot of materials that get clogged there on a routine basis. Some of it's just the nature of the beast, but some of it is that you can't really believe what people put down the system.
I was going to ask. I bet you see some weird stuff.
We do. It's kind of amazing that G.I. Joe makes it all the way to the plant. But, yeah, so once it gets through the lift station and it actually ends up the plant, we have other issues, you know, processing it through there. So it just breaks down the, you know, equipment faster and, you know, costs more in the long run. So.
Okay. So nothing. Nothing unnatural down there.
Nothing unnatural down there. We prefer, yeah.
What else do you want to tell us about?
I guess it's really just the amount of sewage that we treat every year. You know, we treat roughly 1.2 billion gallons a year. There is a huge reinvestment to try to repair our equipment that, you know, probably in our treatment plants hasn't been done as routinely as possible. That's where some of the utility rate fees are going. For example, a lot of the Juno Douglas treatment plant is original components, and that was built in the 1970s. Mendenhall, that is refurbished to its current condition, that was originally in 89. So a lot of that equipment now needs some upgrades. So you know, there's a lot of talk about different fees that we're going, but really it's just to maintain our treatment plants so we can have a good quality of life.
I also noticed on the flyer that you sent out, there are some alternatives, good ways to help people keep stuff out of the sewage. You want to tell us about a few of those?
Sure. We do have, obviously, a pretty good recycling program, both curbside and at the landfill. And, you know, we really do encourage people to use those. And then also the household hazardous waste program, which is really one for us, for example, the cooking oil with Thanksgiving coming up. Please do not put that down the drain. Bring it to the household hazardous recycling. It is really imperative for people to understand that.
And it's open every weekend now, right?
It is, yeah. Oh,
it's so convenient right over there by Costco and
exactly.
Lemon Creek, right?
As you're heading right to Costco or Home Depot.
Okay, so no, if you deep fry your turkey, no oil down the drain.
Right, absolutely.
Okay.
And I think a lot of people don't realize that, but it's kind of just an awareness factor. And the Household Hazardous Waste Program is a really great program.
And restaurants are taking their used oil there now too, right?
They are, yes.
That's great.
Yep.
All right.
And then I do know that JPD has a joint program as well for pharmaceuticals. That's another large one for us that we don't want in the system. I know a lot of people traditionally used to dispose of those in your toilet. Don't do that. You know, please drop them off with JPD, and that would be much better for the environment. They dispose of them appropriately.
Okay. If somebody wanted to get involved in the decision-making process, some of the alternatives you talked about to shipping down south, what would be the best way to do that?
Wow, there's a variety of ways. We do have some information if they want to gain knowledge. There's some information on the wastewater homepage. If they want to be heard, we have the Utility Advisory Board, which meets at least one Thursday every month, and they are actually going through the screening of all the alternatives. And I would say if they would like to have their input heard, to contact them. And they're kind of being the front line for the assembly to technically kind of look through all the alternatives. And then, of course, you know, you can always go to the assembly or contact myself or, obviously, Rory Watt, the Public Works and Engineering Director.
Okay. Samantha, anything else you want to add?
No, it's just been a pleasure being here.
Yeah, thanks for being on the show. Utility Superintendent Samantha Stodinger, did I say that right this time?
Yes.
All right. Thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 9th of November, 2015. It's the birthday of Ivan Turgenev, born in Orel, Russia, 1818, author of Fathers and Sons. It's the birthday of the poet Anne Sexton, born in Newton, Massachusetts, 1928. It was on this day, 1967, the first issue of Rolling Stone magazine was published in San Francisco. It's the anniversary of Kristallnacht, the night in 1938 when German Nazis coordinated a nationwide attack on Jewish homes and businesses and synagogues, inspired by the murder of a German diplomat by a Jew in Paris. And Hitler used that to stage a fake uprising in response. He and Joseph Goebbels contacted stormtroopers around the country, told them to attack Jewish buildings, but to make the attacks look like spontaneous demonstrations. The police were told not to interfere with them and to arrest the Jewish victims instead. Firefighters were told to put out only fires in any adjacent properties, not Jewish properties. In all, more than 1,000 synagogues were burned or destroyed. Rioters looted about 7,500 Jewish businesses, vandalized Jewish hospitals, schools, and cemeteries. Many of the attackers were neighbors of the victims. It was the beginning of the Holocaust. Before Kristallnacht in 1938, the Nazis had killed people secretly and individually. And after Kristallnacht, the Nazis felt free to persecute Jews openly because they knew that nobody would stop them. And it was on this day in 1989 the Berlin Wall came down in Germany. It was a tumultuous year. Poland had free elections. The communists lost. Hungary opened its border with Austria. On November the 4th, more than 500,000 protesters turned out in East Berlin, chanting, "Wir sind das Volk, we are the people." demanding reforms. November 9th was a gray, cold Thursday. East German officials decided to loosen travel restrictions for their citizens, hoping to quiet the unrest. Thousands of East Berliners thronged to the wall. The border guards weren't sure just what to do about it and what was the procedure, but they did not want to open fire. And meanwhile, the crowds were growing larger, and finally the guards had no choice but to let the people through. And in the days that followed, Germans from both sides tore down the wall with hammers and pickaxes and screwdrivers. Here's a poem for today by Anne Sexton entitled Doctors. They work with herbs and penicillin. They work with gentleness and the scalpel. They dig out the cancer, close an incision, and say a prayer to the poverty of the skin. They are not gods, though they would like to be. They are only human, trying to fix up a human. Many humans die. They die like the tender, palpitating berries in November. But all along, the doctors remember, first, do no harm. They would kiss if it would heal. It would not heal. If the doctors cure, then the sun sees it. If the doctors kill, then the earth hides it. The doctors should fear arrogance more than cardiac arrest. If they are too proud, and some are, then they leave home on horseback, but God returns them on foot. Doctors, a poem by Anne Sexton, from The Awful Rowing Toward God, published by Houghton Mifflin and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory and problem-solving through online games, Lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, November 9th, 2015. It's about 18 minutes until the top of the hour. Scott Burton, your host here on a Juno Afternoon. And with me now in the studio is Matt Musselwhite. He is the executive director of the Gastineau Humane Society. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me on this beautiful Juno day.
Oh, right?
Yeah, if it was like 10 degrees colder, Eagle Crest could open tomorrow.
So Friday, wine and beer tasting and silent auction to support all that you guys do, right?
Sure is. So this is our big fundraiser event of the year. It's going to be held at the Jack this year, Gin Arts and Culture Center, the old Armory building. It's at 5:30 p.m. on Friday. It's going to be a great event.
Okay. For folks that don't know exactly what you guys do, I know we talked about it last time you were on the show. Give us a little Gastineau Humane Society 101.
Sure. Well, we've been around almost 52, going on 52 years now. We are the animal shelter for Juno. We provide a safe place for abandoned and unwanted pets in Juno.
Okay. And tell us about the different pets that you have there, and I know some of the services that you have, and dog walking, stuff like
that. Sure, sure. Yeah, well, we have, of course, all sorts of adoptable animals. We have dogs and cats, lots of cats right now. It seems that's pretty standard for us to have at least 30 or 40 cats at a time. We also have small animals, including rabbits, guinea pigs, and other small adoptable animals. So stop on by, check us out.
Remind us where you are.
7705 Glacier Highway. It's between Fred Meyer's and Walmart on the old road.
You guys need any volunteers right now?
We always need volunteers. We always need supplies. You can look up our website at www.ghspets.org. It has a list of volunteer opportunities and things that we commonly use at the shelter that people are encouraged to drop off. You can help us out that way.
Can you see some of the pets on the website, or should you just come by?
Yeah, there's a, well, both is great. Coming by is great. Then you get to interact with an animal, even if you're not intending on adopting. It's nice, and the animals enjoy a little bit of socialization. If you can't do that, you can go to our website. We have a link there to Pet Finder, where we have profiles of all our animals up for adoption.
I imagine taking care of that many critters can't be cheap.
No, it's expensive. And one of the things that we do with these fundraising events, our goal with these is to build up kind of a financial buffer that allows us to spend money on special needs animals, animals that come in with medical problems that can be treated, and the animal can be put in adoption, but, you know, sometimes the only barrier is being able to provide sometimes expensive veterinary care to these animals. So this money from these events goes into our second chance fund and allows us throughout the year to, you know, help those special needs animals.
Okay. And to help fund all of this is the fundraiser on Friday. What's it going to look like?
Sure. So, again, it starts at 5:30 p.m. at the Jack. Tickets are $35. You can get them at GHS. You can also get them online at our website. Again, that's ghspets.org. I'm guessing we're probably not going to be able to have any at the door. We don't have that many left. Last year we sold out a couple weeks beforehand. And I'm thinking we'll probably sell out in the next couple days. So interested in coming, you better stop on by the shelter and go online and take a look there. So at the event, we have a it's a wine and beer tasting event with silent auction. We've got a couple of wine vendors, Odom Corp and K&L Distributing are going to be there. And, of course, Alaskan Brewing is going to have a booth there as well.
Okay, it sounds like fun. What's the website people can go to for more info again?
It's ghspets.org.
And what time does it start on Friday?
5:30 p.m.
All right, Matt Musselwhite, he's the ED at the Gastineau Humane Society. Matt, is there anything else you want to add?
No, that's about it. Lots of great silent auction items available, airline tickets, tourist helicopter tickets, all kinds of great stuff.
Great. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
For the free live television recording of Writer Showcase on Friday the 13th at 7 p.m. at 360. In addition to a reading by special guests John Straley, Frank Katas, Brandon Demery, and Donnie Gott will deliver thoughtful, funny, and gritty pieces by Vivian Faith Prescott, Ed Sasser, and Melinda Moustakis. That's Writer Showcase, actors reading Alaska Writing, Friday the 13th at 7 p.m. at 360 in the K2 building. Admission is free.
All right, you're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, November 9th. It's about 8 minutes until the top of the hour. Got a little extra time on the show today, and thinking about Writer Showcase, which is coming up this Friday night, I thought I'd play you a selection from our last Writer Showcase down at 360. It was a writer's choice show. Here's a piece by John Urban, read by Brandon Demery. Hope you like it. Our next selection by John Urban examines the life of the sometimes enigmatic ski bum. We get a glimpse into what drives skiers and snowboarders into an existence that wholly revolves around snow. Reading Urban's Deluge, please welcome Brandon Demery.
May 2nd, 2009. My car bumper hits the snowbank with a satisfying crunch. Satisfying because it's May. I'm at sea level, and this parking lot still has snowbanks. It snowed a record 196 inches this year down in Juneau. Up at the ski area, there's still 220 inches of base. The snowbank's crunch is even more satisfying because I waited 13 years for a winter like the one we just had. Once upon a time, one February in the last century, my bartender dream girl invited me to visit her little town. She raved about the snowboarding at Eagle Crest, and like everything else she said, I wanted to believe it. So I flew up from Seattle and found that miraculously it was true. The ski area had steeps, well-spaced trees, deep powder, and sun on 7 of the days that I visited here. At night I'd eat kitchen surplus, drink Alaskan tap beer in the dim light, and watch bartender dream girl, aka BDG, closed down her bar. We'd put Stevie Ray Vaughan's Riviera Paradise on the stereo and kissed by the ice machine while dime-sized snowflakes fell outside. I flew home, got packing. I left my job, car, and possibly my senses. My old girlfriend was already moving to a new job in Washington, D.C., where snow conditions suck. So at least that wasn't an issue. 3 weeks later, I was back in Juneau, living with BDG in a small hillside apartment that had been a mining-era brothel. It was bliss. 7 months later, my BDG dumped me for her coke buddy, crushing my heart like a beer can. But like a good bartender tossing empties, she threw me in the right direction. "You belong over at Rogers," she said. "You just like those guys." So I moved onto the living room couch at Rogers Ski Bum Palace, a double-wide dive on the road to Eagle Crest. Roger, Chuck, and Herky had actual bedrooms, but they had no real privacy either. Once ski season began, there could be any number of guests inside. Often our friend and ex-housemate Dawn would park her van outside at the end of a long extension cord, forming an equally loud ski bum enclave in the yard. I know that October is the default season in Juneau, and that October here can last from early August to mid-February. This took years to learn. I wasn't ready yet, and that fall was the longest, darkest, drunkest, rainiest fall of my life. But sometime in calendar November, it finally snowed. And snowed. Then it snowed some more. I didn't have a car. I didn't even have a job beyond snowboarding. But after a hard day at the office, I could walk to the Bonnie Bray subdivision and shovel snow off roofs for beer, ramen, and Advil money. Eagle Crest was closed Tuesdays and Wednesdays, which I learned was the official ski bum weekend. Monday was our Friday, and the party always started, often in the parking lot, as soon as the lifts closed. For the next two days, snow would pile up on the mountain, unmolested, setting us up for Big Thursday. It was an epic winter all the way to April. And when I took off for a 10-day road trip to Valdez for a ski competition, the trip was serendipitous, too. An hour before I left, I learned that one of my roommates had crabs, and I dashed out before I had to clean the double wide. Then, in the late 90s, winter went away. Ocean currents had shifted, and the jet stream started hosing us with warm Pineapple Express storms straight out of Hawaii. Snow became a rare and precious gift. Some years, Eagle Crest would open in early December, then get rained down to mud and close before Christmas break. Often, there would be self-erasing.
Let's hope we have a winter like that this year. You can hear the rest of that story by going to 360north.org. Tune in tomorrow to a Juno afternoon, and Ben Brown will be your host. We'll talk a little bit more about Writer Showcase coming up on Friday, like you were just listening to. We'll get the details about the writers and the performers. Tristan Newton Lombardo will be here to highlight Sales Annual Gala and Auction. Grace Elliott will discuss Sunday's Community of Compassion event. We'll get a preview of upcoming productions by Theater at Latitude 58. Steve Kosas will be here to highlight this week's planetarium presentation, and we'll talk with Sarah Radke Brown about second graders getting a tour of the Walter Soboloff building. That's tomorrow on a Juno afternoon. Let's take a look at the weather. It's currently, where's my sheet? It's over here. It's currently 42 degrees at the Juno Airport with gusts up to 38 tonight. Rain, lows around 36. So it looks like the wind is going to decrease to 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tuesday, rain showers likely, snow level 1,000 feet in the afternoon. Highs around 41. Southeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Veterans Day Wednesday calls for rain showers, highs around 40, south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. And Wednesday night through Friday, rain, lows around 36, highs around 42. Stay tuned for the news.